The difference between him and the philosopher is that he reflects casually and superficially, whereas the latter reflects deliberately and deeply, never ceasing to ask questions until all is quite clear to him. It is an oft-heard plaint that philosophy will not fill the kitchen larder. People nowadays say, "Let us put our economic house in order, or our political house in order, and then we shall have time to philosophize." The old Romans said very much the same thing in their proverb, "First one must live, then one may philosophize." People were making the same plaint when Nebuchadnezzar ruled in sultry Babylon, and they will go on making it when the architectural colossi of New York City are but thin phantoms of the past. Every man is perfectly free, therefore, to ignore the stupendous loo problem which life silently sets him, and nobody will care to reproach him for neglecting it. 20th century existence is difficult enough with its stress, strain and struggle to justify a man looking only to his immediate wants and deferring all consideration of such apparently remote questions as philosophy raises. This he usually does. He relegates the whole subject to a few academic hermits who have no better business to attend to than to indulge in such abstruse speculations on an abstract ultimate. Such is his first and superficial glimpse of the place of philosophy. But like many first glimpses, it is quite a questionable one and open to revision with time. The general objection carries the implication that the world can get on quite well without philosophy. It does not occur to the world that those who first decide whither they may best journey before mounting their horses may arrive at a better place than the others who leap on their steeds and rush off they know not where. According to all reports, the world is still trying to extricate itself from the widespread difficulties into which such a practical but unreflective policy has brought it. Its distresses are melancholy attestation to the absence of philosophy from its midst. The particular plaint that it is easier for a rich man to indulge in this study than a poor man, and for a free man than an enslaved one, is certainly true. But here law of compensation starts working here and renders it easier for a poor man to practice philosophy than for a rich one. This truth will become more apparent later. It is also justifiable to say that some amount of free leisure is needed to carry on this study as well as to reflect upon its points, and some amount of educational background is demanded for its understanding. So far as the latter point is concerned, biography is full of instances where men without means have practically educated themselves rather than submit to cultural defeat, and so far as the former is concerned, those who complain that time for study cannot be found have only to steal it from their sleep. In this way they can get at least 1 hour daily. This will not cause them any suffering, for it is little and given in a good cause. But there are others who could make the time more easily. They have too many irons in the fire and should take a few out. They need not neglect essential duties nor cancel existing relationships in order to accomplish this adjustment. But when they have found a way to fit in the study period, they will find their reward with it. Thus the final truth is that the aspiring and the ambitious will always bestir themselves whilst others moan. If none of us then can escape being a philosopher, why should it seem a puerile request to ask that we learn to philosophize correctly, consciously, systematically and with open eyes instead of faultily, sleepily and blindly, in short, to be a real philosopher and not a drifting fool? Our endeavor to deny the supremacy of such generalized directed thought by ignoring it will always be in vain. It cannot be a stupid nor useless pursuit, but rather an indispensable one which would have us lift the whole of our life activity from the level of groping effort to that of a deliberate one. Life presents us with its own educational curriculum in the shape of painful and pleasurable experiences, but the conscious quest of truth is an item which we must ourselves insert. The thoughts that are habitual lead to their consequences in action. The ordinary man's general outlook will always determine the course of his actions just as much as will the philosopher's. But whereas he is usually blown by the wind of circumstance, and hence afflicted by uncertainty, the philosopher has the advantage that he has long reflected and brought to light certain principles of sound action. A male who has never asked fundamental questions, who has never worked out a reasoned attitude of his own, will find himself gripped by doubt or darkness when the first big crisis of his life occurs. On the other hand, he who has mastered true philosophy will be quietly ready in all situations, all eventualities. The lack of predetermined principles leads unwary man to acts detrimental not only to his own well-being but also to that of others. And yet the man of the world is impatient with philosophers. People are even frightened away by the mere sound of the name philosophy. Even Plutarch could glorify only public men, warriors and politicians in his parallel lives. Thus he praised Lycurgus and sneered at Plato for being a philosopher, for while the first stabilized and left behind him a constitution, the other left behind him only words and written books. Nevertheless, philosophy played a leading part in the old Corinthian culture. The Greeks had some regard for right thinking, but the attitude of a jazz-minded age is, why should we fret our foreheads with such problems? Most of the men and women of our time prefer the crude chatter which passes for conversation, and they are satisfied to slip from cradle to grave with both eyes closed. These intellectual incapables have little use for a climb to the mountain tops of thought and a soliloquy in the drearier atmosphere. In the average person's imagination, the subject is a dry, dead and barren tree, a monotonous and colorless weaving of thoughts. There is some good ground for his mental image, because much dubious matter passes for philosophy which is nothing of the loo kind. But when we inquire a little more deeply into the basis of his fear and dislike, we are likely to discover that they arise out of his ignorance rather than out of his acquaintance with the subject. He rightly thinks, however, that it is going to lift his mind from the familiar ground of concrete reality into unfamiliar altitudes of life, and so, like many elderly persons prior to their first flight in an aeroplane, he fears it. And when he happens to meet a desiccated human being who calls himself a philosopher, he adds irritation to his fear, because the man seems to be wandering about in a deserted wilderness where nothing that is fruitful and nothing that is edible can be found. Our scientific friends add to this dismal chorus of complaint. They sneer in disdain at the barren results of the world's 3,000 years of recorded philosophizing. They point with pride to the immense encyclopedia of ascertained and agreed facts which science has attained in less than 300 years. They utter the ancient joke about the philosopher being like a blind man searching in a dark room for a black cat which is not there, although the 20th century has brought the joke up to date by adding a theologian to the philosopher and announcing that he succeeds in finding the cat. He who is so bold as to talk of a philosophy of truth must surely be an ignoramus, unacquainted with philosophical history and raising hopes in himself and others which are foredoomed to vanish dismally. These plaints are just ones. The story of philosophical exploration is a fascinating account of inconclusive adventures in futility. Our history shows that the philosophers have no settled platform of knowledge upon which they can stand in agreement, and that they are still in the realm of conjecture when they attempt to interpret the meaning of the world. What one philosopher built up so convincingly was torn down so cogently by the next. What the 18th century thought to be a fine discovery was disproved and rejected with contempt by the 19th. The venerated systems of one people were thrown into the lumber room by another. Countless pages of innocent paper have been deluged with black ink by eager thinkers, but still the shape of truth remains unseen. Certainly those grave discussions whether life has a graveyard goal or not are as tormentingly unsettled as they ever were. The answers of philosophers to the questions they posed themselves have been as different and opposite to each other as are the North and South Poles. The importance of being frivolous is impressed upon readers every time they take up many of these stilted ponderous pages. They may indeed finally be reduced to exclaim, in Anatole France's flippant and ironic words, "Things have diverse appearances and we know not even what they are. My opinion is to have no opinion." It has already been observed that this same demon of self-contradiction haunts the houses of mysticism and religion too. Is no escape possible from it then? Is Herbert Spencer right in declaring that absolute truth is to be relegated to the domain of the unreachable question mark? Do the religious, the mystical and the philosophical seekers journey along a path which is but a blind endless maze without discernible starting point and without attainable goal? The wonder is that men have not ceased to philosophize altogether. What is it that urges them to construct and reconstruct, to criticize and to destroy? the theories of their predecessors and the speculations of their contemporaries. Why do they not abandon in irritation this vain pursuit and thus follow the example of gifted Persian Omar Khayyam, who when young did eagerly frequent doctor and saint, and heard great argument about it and about, yet even more came out by that same door wherein I went. The fact is that they are ceasing, and with increasing tempo, to philosophize. She who once sat in regal enthronement over the empirical sciences is today a neglected Cinderella. Those who care for the study of philosophy as the pursuit of truth are rapidly diminishing in number. The process of decline in prestige and disappearance in interest is going on all over the world. Germany, which a single century ago could claim to be the home of European philosophy, now scorns that subject as useless and derides it as a mere game of intellectual marbles. India, which, 1,000 years ago, maintained universities like that of Nalanda, where none could obtain admittance save those who could answer the most abstruse metaphysical questions, and where 10,000 students were once to be found despite this difficult initial bar. India, which has fed all the other Asiatic lands with her thoughts, cannot today find sufficient college students to form more than ridiculously small classes in the same subject. Indeed, it is a well-known fact that several colleges have now abolished the chair in philosophy. It has in fact suffered a severe downfall and its systems have become everywhere in the world a collection of desolate antiques, with its professors busy as melancholy curators of this metaphysical museum. Lou, the modern mood is usually irritated by any attempt to entice it into the cobwebbed parlors of metaphysical speculation. The philosophy of truth. Such criticism is justifiable only where so-called philosophy leads away from action and not to it, where it runs around in a vicious circle and remains forever inconclusive, and where it starts its movement of thought with mere fancies instead of with ascertained facts, although even in these cacks it may be useful to those who want to enjoy the intellectual stimulus of mental gymnastics. But all this has nothing to do with the hidden philosophy. The worldwide error which has jumbled personal fancy with philosophy or opinionative theology with metaphysics makes it necessary to utter the warning that the philosophy of truth as revealed in India must not be confused with such philosophical speculation on truth. If half-philosophy and pseudo-philosophy have now run their course and been dismissed, then the way is left open for true philosophy. The former soars into realms of fancy like a free bird, whereas the latter is strictly chained to facts. It begins with them so far as they are available and refuses to outrun them. It takes nothing for granted, starts with no assumptions, no dogmas, no beliefs of any kind. It proceeds solely by the use of strict reasoning upon these facts, the acutest and sharpest reasoning ever practiced by the human mind, and it concludes by applying the test of all human experience. Many famous metaphysicians have exhausted their ingenuity in imagining, for instance, a hypothetical noumenon, substance, spirit, absolute, etc., underlying the world appearance. But the philosophy of truth does not permit either its exponents or its students to seek a single fancy nor accept it without inquiry as true. Spirit may indeed exist, but it has to find out its existence by investigation and not start by assuming it. Fact is its sole foundation and actuality its superstructure. Academic philosophy presents a picture of conflicting opinion chiefly because of the diverse standpoints taken up by philosophers. Only one standpoint is possible to the true philosopher, and that the highest. Such a standpoint must be based on the facts of all experience. Therefore all assumptions, all dogmas, all blind faith, all surrender to sentiment, all dreams of the unseen and unknown, are immediately ruled out of court. Wherever philosophy has failed, its failure has partly been due to violation of this factor. Life can never be satisfactorily interpreted by studying our fancies in place of its facts. To this extent, therefore, genuine philosophy must embrace science, must start with it, must walk by its side, even though it will later outstrip it because it is more venturesome. Science is indeed a part, albeit the preliminary part, of the philosophy of truth. And by science is meant principally the scientific method, the scientific approach, the vast collection of verified facts, but not the fluctuating guesses and opinions of individual scientists. To many a Western person, metaphysical speculation is a hobby or game for dilettantes, or at best an exercise in intellectual ghost hunting. Genuine philosophy is an infinitely more serious and fruitful occupation than that. It regards this life of ours as a precious opportunity to gain eternal profit out of its seeming transiency. Consequently, it cannot afford to waste time on vain or useless efforts which are foredoomed to end disappointingly in emptiness. It uses the method of philosophical inquiry not to find excuses for living less fully but to find guidance for living more so, not to attenuate human interests but to expand them, and not to pursue fleeting specters but to seek the enduring real. We shall consider in a later chapter a further special characteristic of the higher philosophy, which is its actual justification, where all other philosophies fail to do so, of the claim to provide an all-comprehensive world examination and connected synoptic view of life. Its success in proving its claim explains why Indian minds should have succeeded in fully penetrating the world darkness, where Western minds still regard the task either as impossible or as set for possible completion in a remote future. We have already seen that the explanations of religion are excellent for simple or timid folk, but too elementary and too adverse to the conscience and common sense of cultured ones. We have also learned that the tenets and practices of mysticism are ampler and better, but they too are insufficient because they yield only a partial view of life. It is the claim of the hidden philosophy of truth, which will henceforward be named by the single word philosophy in this book, partly as a verbal convenience and partly because the derivation of the word points to truth and not to the mere speculation into which it has frequently degenerated, that it alone seeks to inquire into every phase of total universal existence, leaving nothing out, and it alone strives to get the fullest explanation and the final one. Moreover, it not only starts to inquire but pushes on with iron determination until it successfully reaches the goal. From this statement it may be gathered that true philosophy is no monochrome but is so rich that it must not only embrace the loom methods used by religion, mysticism, science and art, for instance, as well as all the results achieved by them, it must not only take within its scope of examination such diverse matters as business, industry, warfare, marriage and maternity, bright dreams and base drudgery, because they form a part of human life. It must not only include the vast array of animals and plants and rivers and mountains within its examination because they belong to universal existence, but it must even turn back critically upon itself. For, after all, every inquiry, whether it be religious, mystic, scientific or philosophic, is made with the mind. Hence philosophy seeks also to discover why the mind wants to know all these things, why it takes up the quest of truth, and what is its own nature, what are the limits of its capacity to know truth, how it comes to know the world, and what in short is the ultimate truth of all the truths that we already know. It demands truth in its entirety, not half or quarter truths. Philosophy values the contributions of the departments of fact or faith already named, and indeed of all others, whilst escaping from their restricted specialism because it refuses either to pause at any single one of them or to limit its inquiry to it. Science, however valuable it be in providing us with a reasonable approach to life and in organizing our knowledge of the world, is obviously limited. It deals in fragments. The average scientist cannot be expected to understand the significance of music, for example. He works, like all specialists, with blinkers, for he keeps within a certain department and has to accept both the limitations and the constricted views of that department. Every specialist is unconsciously influenced by the emphasis placed upon the particular aspect of life with which he concerns himself. The consequence is that he forces his notion of truth within the confining walls of a compartmental outlook and ignores the goal of truth as it is when freed of such limitation. However workable this be for practical purposes, it becomes a hindrance when the wider objective of ultimate, universal and uncontradictable truth is set up. It is hard to know how to place so remarkable a mental attitude, for it is too up-to-date to be antique, too rational to be medieval and too historic to be modern. Such is the paradox of the world's most archaic wisdom, which is still so far in advance of contemporary knowledge that we are only now beginning to catch up with it. Such is the uniqueness of a philosophy which is a courageous endeavor to get at the meaning of existence, to use man's loftiest faculty of intelligence for the loftiest imaginable aim, and to discover an adequate criterion for ethics, an unassailable canon of truth and wisdom for the sustenance of social action. Only the superficial dare doubt its practical utility and marked advantage, but admittedly such an endeavor does not belong to the everyday life of the crowded plains. It must necessarily belong to distant mountain trails. The plain dweller is entitled to refuse to forego his comforts and travel to this unfamiliar region, but let him not despise those who put fear aside and essay the climb. They will find no dullness there, but on the contrary a fascinating and stimulating adventure. It is really engrossing and, when its full practical bearing appears on the horizon of study, will be found to hold vital human interest. Henceforth the episodes of their everyday personal lives will be seen against a perspective of growing grandeur. We have seen how the approach to truth arranges itself in a graded series, and have followed it to the end of its second phase. This is in accord with the ancient Indian teaching, which postulates three stages of evolution through which the mind of man must pass, three progressive attitudes towards life. The first is religion and is based on faith, the second, mysticism, is controlled by feeling, and the third, philosophy, which is inclusive of science, is disciplined by reason. Nor can it be otherwise, for man's understanding of the world must necessarily grow parallel to his mental capacity. His outlook is invariably and inevitably limited by the degree of his intelligence. Hence it is impossible for all men to answer life's queries in the same way. We must stand now at the door of the third degree in the archaic temple of wisdom and knock hopefully. If we are to reach our optimum development, we must cross this threshold and learn what lies beyond it. Over the lintel we may behold deeply carved in dignified lettering four words, the philosophy of truth, whilst above them the figure of Minerva's owl is solemnly staring at us. For this peculiar bird becomes active when the shades of night are falling, and it clearly sees varied objects where man sees only sable darkness. But who has ever heard of such an unlabeled philosophy? We have heard of German philosophy, Greek philosophy, Indian philosophy. We remember as from a remote past some of the world's most unintelligible volumes, written by the world's most intelligent men, marring our student days with tormenting emotions of confusion, despair and final bafflement. We recollect having fuddled our brains by reading a spate of tedious books on the subject, but instead of advancing us into clearer light the contradictory theories and speculations carried us back into greater darkness. We believed ironically what seems to be a general rule in philosophical discussion, lo that the more trivial the point at issue the graver became the argument. We have picked up a little of the lingo of the system of Spinoza, the system of Anaxagoras, the system of Immanuel Kant, but we have never found, nor do we know of anyone who has ever found, a philosophy which represented more than the views of one man or one school. There exist a few, however, who have thoroughly explored the twilight lands of religion, mysticism and metaphysics and not merely coasted along their shores, who know also what science can say about the world, and who possess no such pessimism. Their initial wonder has waxed into the desire to know, and this again into the passion to understand, and that finally into the search after reality. They feel that this all-engrossing search which has driven them onward and upward reacts in response to something that is. An inextinguishable hope lures them. For what they had half believed with religion, fully felt with mysticism, rationally suspected with science and speculatively argued with metaphysics is that some ultimate essence exists as the true nature of things and men, that this essence, being ever and everywhere present, bestows the highest possible significance on the universe, and consequently the first and highest human duty is personally to know it. But they perceived that before it can be finally and certainly known in any way it must first be intellectually and speculatively known for what it is and certainly for what it is not. Hence, they realize the need of a fitting philosophy, not the philosophy of this or that school, person or country, but solely the philosophy of truth. Such a philosophy, if discovered, would act as an indispensable map with which the explorer could then set out to discover the truth for himself. But why should not the hope of these unconventional few be nothing more than self-deception, an illusion created by personal desire masquerading as profound intuition? Only one answer is possible to this just complaint, but it is an answer which will raise surprised eyebrows and curl sneering lips in Western circles suffering from superiority complexes justifiable perhaps by sheer ignorance of what men have been doing and thinking in the other hemisphere for the past few thousand years. However, it possesses as much a right to our ear as any other, as will be amply demonstrated during the course of this book. It is the bold declaration that the hope of a few has been converted, at infrequent intervals however, into the tested realization of uncommon individuals, and that whatever the public archives of world thought may say, both the unwritten and written records of India indicate that the truth which the West deems unattainable has already been attained by such individuals in the past and may even now be attained by those who prize it enough to pay its high cost. When we have witnessed the wonders which the human mind has achieved in changing the earth's face, are we to be so hopeless as to believe that the whole of nature fears the unveiling of truth and has cunningly plotted to prohibit man from ever understanding the ultimate significance of his life on this planet? And if anyone asserts that this significance is quite unknowable, then he is unconsciously affirming that he is already aware of what future generations may or may not succeed in knowing. An entirely unjustifiable and unprovable assumption. But why can we not condescend to learn from the ancients what we cannot learn from the moderns? The secret doctrine of India, an Indian recondite doctrine, which constitutes this philosophy of truth and is placed on a level higher than those of religion and mysticism, has existed during a period which scholars admit cannot be less than 5,000 years in extent, but is in fact very much older, for its origin disappears into historically untraceable epochs. It was the traditional possession of a few initiates who formed a closed exclusive circle and who guarded it with great care as being the acme of all their country's wisdom, permitting none save qualified aspirants to have access to it. Indeed, until the dawn of the modern era, a Brahmin who dared reveal that the truth which lies latent in religion becomes actual only in philosophy was liable to be punished. They transmitted it from generation to generation, but kept it so firmly secret in the process that the stray echoes which floated accidentally or surreptitiously into the large air world quickly became queerly distorted ones. Self-styled and self-deceived representatives appeared in public later and turned the few echoes of pure philosophy which they had heard into religious scholasticism in some cases or into theological mysticism in others. Miscomprehension led to mutilation, and thus converted a grandly universal into a shrunken tribal truth. Nevertheless, even when its true and faithful living representatives all but died out or disappeared from this earth, it maintained an immortal existence in a few rare neglected writings and fragmentarily in several more popular ones. However, erroneous interpretations invariably result from their being read without the proper personal elucidation by a competent teacher, which is indispensable. It is therefore to be expected that several of the explanations which are being given in these chapters may be denied as unauthentic lore by most of the learned scholars of present-day India or abused as perversions by the generality of her conventional mystics and yogis or denounced as atheistic by the majority of her religious authorities. Let it be so. We do not address ourselves to them or their numerous followers but to strictly truth-seeking minds. The truth may be hidden from view for countless ages, for it depends on the secret suffrages of a rare few, but it is unkillable, it will outlive like the vast ocean the froth of mortal opinion and the foam of prejudiced interests. Although our unconventional presentation of this knowledge is a modern and Western one, its original source is an ancient and Indian one. Both silent texts and living voices which have informed our writing are mostly Indian, supplemented by some Tibetan documents and a personal Mongolian esoteric instruction. A million men may gainsay the tenability of the tenets unfolded here, but none can gainsay the fact that they are Indian tenets, albeit little known, without twisting the most authoritative ancient documents to suit their mediocre minds. If we do not quote those texts here, it is because our readers are primarily Western and we do not wish to burden them with the troublesome necessity of exploring exhaustive glossaries for unfamiliar Sanskrit names.